My name is Laura Barone Lopez. I'm a reporter for Huffington Post. I cover Congress, and I'll be moderating the panel. And so the two speakers I have with me are Russ Choma of Mother Jones. He covers money and politics and influence in their D.C. bureau, and he also used to report for OpenSecrets.org. And then I also have Edwin Bender, the executive director of the National Institute on Money and State Politics, and their website is followthemoney.org. So just to lay a few ground rules first, for the Q&A session, which should take up the majority of our time, SEJ members, ones with blue tags, get to ask questions first. Please identify yourself when you ask a question. Before you ask it, and we just discourage any speech making. So let's get started. I kind of wanted to set the stage a bit. In the last 5 years, the dynamics of money in politics have changed substantially. The trickle probably began a little bit in 2007, but the two turning points were 2010 Citizens United and 2014's McCutcheon decisions by the Supreme Court really changed the fabric of elections and the influence in money and politics and policy. So given these changes, which have only made it easier for industry, influential stakeholders, and powerful individuals to elect who they want and push their policy agenda in Washington or at the state level, it's been increasingly difficult for journalists like ourselves to track that money. So last year, some of you may know, Tom Steyer and the Koch brothers were pretty influential on the national scale. Steyer was trying to make climate change a wedge issue. And so I just wanted the first question to both of you is, this election cycle, where are each of you seeing the greatest impact from industry or individual stakeholders on energy and environment policies? Russ, you can maybe speak to the national level, and Edwin to the state level.
So I think the one thing that's really striking, is this on?
Yeah.
You guys hear me?
Yeah.
Is the concentration of the money and where it's coming from. And I just saw this right before I came here, and I was just telling Ed, the New York Times, if you go to the New York Times website right now, they've got a really cool sort of graphic, and it represents where the money's coming from in the election so far this year. And the graphic they use is 120 million households, and they have a little green Monopoly house for every one of them, and it's this big, huge mountain. And then it's like, out of 120 million households in America, half the money in this election so far is coming from 158 families. So 158 people out of 120 million is where the money's coming from. So there's a very, very limited number of people who are making a significant contribution this time. That's one thing. And so one candidate who has one significant backer in an industry can become very, very important. And so I think that's the thing, is you don't even need an entire, like, the oil industry to get on the side of one presidential candidate. You just need one guy. In some ways, makes it harder to say, well, the industries are doing this, or, you know, coal is doing this, or oil is doing that. But at the same time, it's also a little bit easier to identify exactly what some of these people are after. And one thing, just one sort of quick anecdote that I was thinking about was earlier this summer, when I first started at Mother Jones, and I was looking around for stories, and I reached out to some GOP fundraisers in Texas, and I was just talking to them about who they liked and what candidates they liked. And the thing that was interesting was they had nothing to say about Scott Walker. I said, well, you know, so I was asking about it. I was like, Scott Walker, and they said, one of the guys said, you know, he's nothing, no interest. And he said, the donors of Texas, they don't care about him. One trick pony, who cares? Big deal in Wisconsin, but down here, we don't care about him. And it was interesting because Texas is the largest source of GOP money every single cycle. It's the state that gives a third amount on the federal level, and it gives almost entirely vast majority of it to Republicans. So if you want to be a successful Republican candidate on the national level, you have to get money from Texas. And what these guys were telling me was that the donors in Texas did not like Scott Walker. He wasn't coming down to greet them. He wasn't doing anything for them. And there was no money from Texas going to Scott Walker. And I, you know, when I talked to these guys, they're donor advisors and fundraisers, and I asked them, like, who do you sort of represent? And they said the extractive industries. In Texas, there's a lot of money. It's oil, coal, natural gas, and then people who have inherited money from their parents or grandparents who made it in oil, coal, natural gas. And so I like to think that now I saw Scott Walker's demise coming, but But I think that in retrospect, it should have been obvious, because he wasn't getting this sort of key, if you want to be a successful GOP candidate at the national level, this is a key demographic you have to hit, the wealthy oil, coal, and natural gas people in Texas. And he was not making inroads with them, and so his candidacy was just not going to go anywhere in the long run. But anyway, so it's still that sort of same story, a very small group of people who... A very, very small group of people are having a very, very outsized influence on it, and in the case of Republicans, a lot of it is the extractive industries.
So at the state level, I'd say right now it's very early in the election cycle to be playing the horse race story game, and in fact, we encourage you not to do that when you're looking at our data. What's happening right now, setting the stage for the 2016 elections, has been a long run-up. We have, if you look at the National Council state legislatures, you have things going on across the country around like net metering, renewable portfolio standards. Those battles have been going on for 4, 5, 6 years now. There was early on, there was a push to get the renewable portfolio standards, for example. And so they passed, everybody wants to be recycling, get renewables in. What's going on right now is a very concerted push across the country to roll back renewable portfolio standards, to try to make sure industry is still in control of power lines, the net metering piece. So industry is retrenching to try to ensure that it has a... its profit margins remain the same, and it's moving slowly. Corporations are moving to protect their investment, but also to plan for the future. And many of the big companies are moving into renewables as part of their delivery product. So in the policy world, if you go to the National Conference of State Legislatures, you can see a really nice, it's NCSL, a really nice summary of state and federal energy. It's a newsletter, plug-ins, NCSL, state and federal newsletter on energy, different policy areas that there will be intersections. When you look at our data, and what our data helps inform is how that run-up across the last decade, what it looks like. And if you pull out just oil and gas donations, and I think when I get to a PowerPoint here I'll be able to do that, you can see that oil and gas has been giving, they give whoever's in power, so they give to incumbents and they give to whichever legislature is party is controlling the legislature, they give to that. So you'll see the dollars go up and down. Where it gets kind of interesting, coal is another one, where the dollars they're giving to state lawmakers is up and down depending on the office or who's in control of the legislature. The two interesting places I was looking at, nuclear energy right now is under assault, and people are trying to roll back the nuclear energy deliveries, and there's a spike in the last two cycles. There's been a spike in nuclear energy donations to try to protect themselves. Conversely, the alternatives, which were not donating, not big players, there's been a spike in their donating because they're trying to actually protect what they have had. So you have right now a really interesting dynamic in the legacy power companies trying to protect where they're at and ensure their profits in the future. And some industries are fighting for their life, and others are fighting for a new life. It's a very fluid situation. Hopefully I can show you. We have a booth out back where if you want to like dig into this, I'd be happy to spend some time with you.
Okay, great. Well, Edwin, if we want to just move on to your...
Your little
PowerPoint demo. He's going to show you how you can utilize the tools that are on followthemoney.org.
And I have to do two-handed?
Yes.
Okay.
Do you want the PowerPoint or the
website? Just do the PowerPoint first, and then I'll let you get me to the website. So we're going to make this pretty short and sweet, the PowerPoint piece. If you help steer, sure, that's perfect. So what we're going to do is go back, and if you go to just followthemoney.org, you're going to see the Ask Anything engine. And what I've done here for the very first piece, new presentation, just if you, yeah, click on the left-hand side, go to slideshow somewhere. There it is, slideshow off to the right. After your right, slideshow, play from start. So here's what our front end looks like. You can see some real basic stuff. You go to the start here, and you'll find options for selecting data, where the contributions go to, where they come from. So what I do, if you go to the next slide, what I've done very simply here is go in and look at oil and gas contributions across many years. So we're looking now, that's my question, you build a query, now you get 125,000 contributions for over $215 million. So what our data navigator does is let you start analyzing this, data navigator right up there. And you can click on any of these buttons, and it will analyze that $215 million. So if you go to the next slide, we see that this is donating across the years that I selected. These are sortable fields, so you can select on the election year to get the most recent. You can see that 2014, 55 million, 2010, 57. You can sort this. Again, if you go to followthemoney.org, create an account at the bottom, you're able to download this or use JSON or XML to flow it to your web pages. So if we go to the next tab, which is number 3 there, here we just said we want to see what the general office, where did all that money go to? Gubernatorial campaigns, obviously, is at the top, very powerful place to make donations, House and state and the courts also. The next slide, we select the general party, and we selected 2 here. We want to say how much money went to incumbents and how much went to the general party. So the reason we're concerned about incumbents, if you're coming into a legislative arena and you have a strategy, you want to move your legislation, this isn't rocket science. You give to incumbents first, you give early, and you give big because they win 90% of the time or better. And when they lose, then you give to the challenger. And so this is the way you ensure that upwards of 90% of your money, your investment in politics, is going to people who will be sitting at the table who you and your lobbyists will be talking to. So in this case, we see that of all that oil and gas money, the Republican incumbents got $56 million. Republicans for open seats who were challenging Democrats got $33 million. Democrat incumbents got $16 million. So this is a way you can mix and match your selections here to analyze the data in great depth. And what you download when you do download a CSV or a tab limit is what you see on the screen. So you can actually build a story starting with how much did they give, which states did they give to, which years, how much to incumbents, who were the most powerful candidates. If we do the next slide, we also collect donations not just to candidates but to party committees and to ballot measures. So this is what all that money they've given to the California Republican Party and the California Democrat Party. This is a trend you'll see across the country. They give to both sides of the aisle, whether to candidates or to the party committees, because they don't care about politics. They care about getting the votes they need to pass their legislation. This is more about a business plan than it is about politics. Next slide would be the ballot measures. So in the process of moving their business plan, if they have problems that they can't solve or if they're under attack, then they'll go to ballot measures. And they'll spend more. You see $22 million here for California for energy independence. They will spend more on a ballot measure campaign than they spend across the country donating to candidates. It's kind of a mudslide situation. And that's what you'll see. We don't have the independent spending at the state level like you do at the federal level. It's not disclosed. But what we know about independent at the state level is it mirrors the ballot measure stuff. It's mudslides of money flowing to very particular places to have a very particular effect, whether it's on a gubernatorial race, attorneys general, or a group of candidates. Next slide is this shows you, so when you go to this data and you click on the bar chart, we've selected this and just said election year and general party. This shows you the increase in oil and gas donating to Republicans. As part of that shift is a control of legislatures across the country. Some of it is also an industry that's under attack. And the next slide, I believe, is the country. Again, just a breakdown. And the last one would be, you know, me and Eve, our name. If you can go to the web page, I want to show one more thing very quickly. What we've done, the data is just, I mean, it tells a story. And it's okay if you're doing a horse race story. We want to try to give you the history behind the money, why people are playing in politics. But what we want to do, what we've done is try to put the data in a place where you see the intersections of influence. Where are the PowerPoints? The academic, is that the web page? Okay, scroll down a little bit and scroll to the My Legislature, right there. So what we've done here is take our data, and if you scroll down a little bit, this is not very easy to see. Let's select on Alabama. There you go. Select on Oklahoma. Make Alabama into Oklahoma. Keep going down. There you go. And so what we've done is mash our data with lawmakers and legislative committees and legislation. So we're going to give you an opportunity here to investigate to see what bills are flowing through the legislature, and we have this for all 50 states, who sponsored those bills, who donated to the sponsors, which committees did those bills go to, and who donated to the committee members, and then who donated to the whole legislature. So this is the legislature. Just for in the interest of time, just scroll all the way to the bottom, Laura. So this is what the legislature looks like. Now you need to go off to the side. So it's scrolling the legislature. Now go a little bit farther over to the, there you go, right there. That's the committees. Now keep going down. Now here's legislation, and I picked up one bill that I think might be of interest somewhat. Oklahoma, we had House Bill 1107. So scroll down. This is going to be hard to see, isn't it? Keep going, keep going, keep going. It has to do with fracking. And this is how the meat of the story. After your elections, you're going to be wondering, who is this guy who supported him? Keep going, keep going, keep going, keep going. Keep going, 11, we're at 1075, 9, 11, whoop, there, 1107. And you're going to, okay, down, 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 right. That's it, there. Click on it. So that's going to show you then what this piece of legislation, the language for this piece of legislation. And if you scroll up a little bit, go over to where it says sponsors, off to the right or left. So there's the sponsor. Now we can go to top donors to sponsor. And this is where it starts getting a little bit interesting. So there's the top donors. Chesapeake Energy is there. If we go to events, which is the next tab over, that shows you then this went to the Environmental Law Committee. So if we scroll back up to the committees, we can find the Environmental Law Committee, right? Keep going up a little bit, right? Up, right there. Perfect. So there's your Environmental Law Committee. If you click on that, there are the members. And if you scroll up there, you can see contributors to those committee members. So if we click on that, and so you can see how this will work. You find places where the donors overlap with legislation. One last click here, and you can go up to the top. I click on Chesapeake. Well, you have an interesting thing I saw here. Scroll this up. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, you can. Yeah. So we have things like balance forwards, contributions under the reporting threshold. We balance our books to what the candidates report. So you're going to see some of that kind of stuff in there. And that's just us making sure that we're not leading you astray. Let's stay on this. Can you bring this back up a little bit? Nope, other way. Nope, not there. Down. There, yeah. Okay, all I want to do here is click on the name. If you click on any of those magnifying glasses, you're going to go into the data. If you click on the name, go up to Chesapeake Energy. Because what we do when we create an entity is we bring all the data together in one place. So Chesapeake Energy, click on that. If you scroll over it, you'll get some details. But this will tell you, in the big picture, how much Chesapeake Energy is given, who their lobbyists are, what their giving trends are, and we're not loading very well. So I want to end with that, but hopefully it's kind of whetted your appetite for the kind of power that we're giving you to dig into stories, to start following the legislative trails. We are adding lobbyists, what their salaries are. It's often 3, 4, 5 times what they make in campaign contributions, what they're paying their lobbyists. So there's some very rich new data that we'll be adding. You'll see this load, and there'll be candidates, party committees, and all that sort of stuff. So thank you.
Okay, and Russ was just going to, shortly before we dive into the Q&A section, talk about some other tools that you guys could use to track money in politics.
So I think when Ed was talking, it was making me think. One of the my favorite things about campaign finance and about some of this data is you know, well, the frustrating thing about it is that it's just data and it's just by itself. And a lot of the times you have trouble sort of making something match, but there's a lot of opportunities where the opportunities for the really good story is when you can cross two sets of data. And, you know, Ed was talking about, you know, this is where you can find the lobbyists and this is where you can find, you know, the legislation. And I think, you know, what they're doing, tying the legislation in with the contributions and making it easy to see, that's really, really helpful. And I think there's a lot of different tools that you can use and try to collect as many different sort of streams of data that you can try to cross. And I think one of the nice things about the environmental sort of beat is that there is a lot of regulatory framework where there's a lot of information available about some of these companies in terms of, I'm talking about addresses and individuals who are on paperwork and phone numbers and PO boxes and things like that. Some of the tools, I used to work at OpenSecrets.org, which is the Center for Responsive Politics, which is very similar to Follow the Money, except it's only on the federal level. One thing that they've done is they've started to get into a lot of the dark money stuff, you know, the politically active nonprofits, which is actually, you know, for example, the Kochs and some of the other energy companies are very involved with that. And they've got a great site. And it's built on a lot of the same principles. Everything is broken down by industry, and there's organizational profiles. And so you can look up a member of Congress, and you can see what industries are the top sources of money, and then you can see what organizations. And you can see how much comes from the PAC, how much comes from individuals, how much comes from lobbyists that are employed by them. You can see what pieces of legislation that they've sponsored and who has lobbied on the legislation, and of the people who lobbied, who was it that gave money to the member. And that's an example of bringing the lobbying together with the legislation, together with the campaign finance. And that's, you know, there's no silver bullet that solves everything, but that's where there's the most sort of smoke, and that's really good context for a story.
And since you brought that up, I guess I'll just bring up one of my final questions and then we'll move on to your guys' questions. But talking about dark money, and you referenced the Koch brothers. So their organizations are, you know, Americans for Prosperity. There's also Heritage. There's Center for American Progress. That isn't attached to Kochs. But those are all some kind of think tanks or nonprofits that are able to, that money is coming into and out of, that is dark money, as you referenced. And you recently wrote a story about California cracking down on that dark money. Could you just explain a little bit of what they did?
So dark money is I mean, it's just sort of a made-up term. There's no official definition. It's just money that we don't know where it came from. And the easiest place for it to come in is through something called politically active nonprofits. You know, you've got charities, which are not allowed to be political, and then you've got a variety of politically active nonprofits, which are allowed to be political in, to a certain degree. And in exchange, they don't get, you know, donations are not tax deductible. And, you know, there's some examples, like the Sierra Club is a very, very prominent example of a politically active nonprofit that's been around for a long time. If you want to save the wolves, you've got to go to Washington and lobby and talk to people about saving the wolves. But other people, since Citizens United, have been able to make use of this. And the Kochs have America's Prosperity. They've got a couple other organizations. We don't know all the organizations they have. That's the problem. But what happens is you see these groups, and they pop up, and they have these really bizarre, generically bizarre names. And you can't figure out who they are and what they want based on the name. But they pop up. They've been popping up on local and state issues. And the federal government is not doing anything about it. The FEC is in terrible shape. These are nonprofits, and so theoretically they're under the jurisdiction of the IRS, and the IRS is under attack for being remotely political. And even before that happened, the IRS wanted nothing to do with any of this. The IRS just wants to collect taxes. They don't want to regulate politics. And so the states are kind of the only people who are doing anything about this, and California has sort of been one of, New York is trying to, but California has been one of the more active ones. And they had a really interesting case from 2012. There was a Koch-affiliated group from Arizona called, Center for Patients' Rights, right?
Yeah.
Center to Protect Patients' Rights, which was a mailbox in Arizona. And what it did, is it served as a clearinghouse for hundreds of millions of dollars that mostly came from the Kochs, but also came from some of their friends. And then it was distributed back out to state-level groups. And they sent some money to California, to some groups in California. And the regulators in California said, if you want to play in California, you have to tell us where your money came from. And they fought over it. The judge set a deadline for them to disclose their donors. And at like 11:59, if the deadline was midnight, 11:59, they came through and they said, okay, we got our money from this group in Arizona, Center to Protect Patients' Rights. And that was sort of where it ended. So it can be very frustrating to get beyond that. But at the same time, California sort of decided to do something about it, and they've got some newer rules saying that, you know, if you want to play in California, you have to say where you got your money from. And then recently they just had they sort of tightened and made sure that there was no loopholes, and they said, even if you're not from California, even if you're a federal group, even if you're from Oklahoma, if you're wherever you're from, if you are going to put money into California, you must say where you're getting it from. And that's significant, because since no one on the federal level is doing anything, you know, California is saying, you know, they can't regulate everything, but they're like, if you come near California, we're going to come after you, even if you're not from here. So your state, it'd be interesting to look at your state regulators and see what they're doing, because some of them are actually very, very active. But again, you can, that's where you also, you find these names on the state level, and then you can begin going through some of the tools like Open Secrets. One thing I thought of that is really, really good story that came out recently, Li Fang, working at The Intercept, did this thing recently where a lot of coal companies are going into bankruptcy. And when you go into bankruptcy, you have to lay out all of your finances. And so he went through some of the bankruptcy filings for one coal company, and he found the payments that they were making to some of these dark money groups. And bankruptcy filings are incredibly intimidating and long. But, you know, if you know the industry a little bit, if you know the company a little bit, and if you've got a lot of time, there's probably some good things in there, because a lot of coal companies are going under right now. And that's the kind of thing. Even if they're not going under, a company that has regulation, it has to file a lot of paperwork. And so there's a lot of really great clues in there.
Great. Thank you, Russ. And just another example, if you guys want to read, on my flight over here, the New York Times wrote a piece on petroleum industry gains momentum and push to end the U.S. oil exports ban. And they talked a lot about how the industry has, you know, used think tanks, and which is what he was just talking about, to then go and issue reports and go to Capitol Hill and talk to them about, you know, changing this decades-long policy, which hasn't been changed in the U.S. And so now we'll move to Q&A. Yes, could you please identify yourself?
So, yeah, on our website, I don't know if we can get back to that, but that says top contributors, and we aggregated those, and you'll see the number of donors. Our records match exactly what's there. So if you're in Oregon and you want to go in and download a database of Oregon, every single contribution, it's there. Yeah, it'll match everything that a candidate has. So go up and, yeah, click on the logo there. And... yeah, I mean, we don't have to go through it. We can go through that if you want to visit. I can show you how to do that. But if you sign in and create right there a My Follow the Money account, when you get to the bottom, and so we can do that. So it's everybody. Yeah, we just aggregated in that particular view. So you can say, you know, if you're in the energy committee, you want to see who are the energy donors. There are a couple different ways we can do that. I'll let Russ speak to the CRP question, because... while we're collecting federal candidates, CRP is absolutely the place you want to go. They're the experts on federal data and everything federal. They are the local knowledge there.
So the question about lobbying, there are a couple of different things there to unpack. You're correct that not everything goes onto those reports. And that's the problem, is that, I mean, part of it is just you can't possibly come up with a system that gets everything. And what is lobbying? You know, there's a federal definition of lobbying, and there's a federal definition of what's a lobbyist. And some people don't fall into it for good reasons, and some people actively seek to avoid falling into it and are shirking their rules. And so those are some holes. And, I mean, an example would be, you know, grassroots lobbying. You know, a lot of trade associations, they'll bring the CEOs of companies in their industry to Washington, and they'll set the CEOs out onto Capitol Hill to go and to offices and talk to people. Those CEOs are not lobbyists. They're not... you know, they don't have to report any of that. You know, you only have to report what your actual lobbyist does. There's that. There's also on the reports what they do, and every state is different. Ned might know a little more about this, but every state's different, so I think it's hard to make a blanket statement about what happens at the state level. But on the federal level, you're supposed to write down what you lobbied on. Yeah, so, I mean, you list your bills and stuff, but you don't have to say which way you lobbied. And you don't have to say how much you spent. You have to say, I spent $1 million on these 12 issues. And so it's a very, very flawed system. But it's the thing is that it's the best system we have, and so you haven't done anything wrong. It's impossible to ever get it, and so you have to, I mean, there has to be a lot of caveats always, but I think that you seem like you're on the right track.
And at the state level, it's even worse. About half the state's lobbyists don't really disclose anything.
Some states are great, though.
We're collecting lobbyist expenditures in about a dozen states where we get good information, what their salary is, what they're lobbying on. But, we're not getting much of anything except that they are registered lobbyists and who their clients are. And we're able to correlate those and begin to tell that story. But the other piece that Russ sort of alluded to is that not only are the laws fragmented and complicated, enforcement just doesn't exist in any of these. And even in the campaign finance world, very seldom do you see any sort of action. And when you do see an action by a disclosure agency, as happened in Wisconsin recently, actually it's happening right now, their commission is being under assault from the legislature for doing their job. And there may be significant changes in Wisconsin. That happens all the time. So if you do your job, you get penalized. If you don't do your job, the public, is hurt.
So we mentioned this a moment ago. It's not just PAC contributions. It's not just lobbying. It's not just the think tanks setting the whole thing up. It's not just the grassroots stuff. It's this big, giant, like on a lot of these issues, it's a big, giant effort. But there are common ties between them. And I've actually found, state lobbying records didn't tell me what I wanted to tell me or wanted them to tell me, but I did find that the lobbyist's address and his phone number, and then that lobbyist's address and phone number also came up on a 990 form with the IRS saying that they ran a nonprofit that was talking about this issue. And so, again, you can't always find what you want, but the more sort of different sets of data that you can pull in and begin crossing, you start to get somewhere.
Okay, next question. Yes.
Hi, Clint Wilder with CleanEd. My understanding is that only one state, Ohio, has been successful so far. Do you track results of all this money? What I'm trying to get at is, given that they haven't been successful except for Ohio,
We cannot get to the outcomes other than what you see in the legislature, my legislature tool, getting to the place where it's signed by the governor. We may get there one of these days. The big data stuff is growing, and we're linking with more and more data. So getting to those places but it is difficult still. I don't think you're going to see any rollback anytime soon. I think the fact that they've only been successful in one state simply speaks to maybe the larger shifts in the industry. I mean, you're seeing more and more Priuses on the road, and people are going to LED lights. And, I mean, people really, when we talk about energy independence and you talk about coal, or still having centralized coal electric, I think there's a major shift taking place across the country. And industry is having to fight very hard to maintain its status quo in some policy areas. And so, as the economy shifts, as business plans, marketing shifts, and as public demand shifts, I think it's going to be harder and harder for them to roll back some stuff. That's why more and more of them are jumping on the bandwagon and leasing rooftops for solar panels. More and more power companies are jumping onto the renewables and figuring out ways to create more, to co-opt, I guess, the alternatives.
Personal energy independence, like solar, that cuts across.
Yeah, absolutely.
One problem that you always will have is that if you ever find an instance where you can show that money affected the outcome, that's bribery. And someone will go to jail for it. So that's the thing, is that all this always dances right up to the edge. You can't quite prove that it happened, but you can be awfully sure. And that's one thing, your editors will be like, are you just implying something here? And to a certain degree with the money, yes, you have to always sort of imply. But there's very, very strong, and this, when I was at Open Secrets, you say this, and I'm sure you say it too, that, you do this long enough, these people are not giving the money for fun. They're not giving it for altruistic reasons. They're getting something from it. You have to be careful not to say they gave money and they got that, because you can't prove it. And if you can prove it, like I said, it's bribery. And that's a really great story, so you should look. Yeah. But it is always going to be a little bit of a tough thing. And you have to keep that in mind, especially when you're dealing with your editor and they're maybe not happy about it. But the great thing about Follow the Money and Open Secrets, and Sunlight Foundation is another one, and MapLight is another one, is that they help you get into the data, and they show it to you. It's an easy access to it. And then all of them have some form where you can get to the underlying thing. So, you know, you can show your editor using these tools, look at where I'm going with this, and then when they show, like, say, you know, I want to see something more, you can get to the underlying lobbying form, the underlying, you know, thing that was filed with the state or with the federal government. So, but that is always a frustration that you can't ever 100% prove it, and if you can, someone should be in jail.
Yeah, the difference between causality and correlation is significant. So, you know, look those words up and kind of drill that into your brain. We're showing correlations. You show causality, that's bribery.
Next question. Yes. Please identify yourself.
So, you know, right. I mean, everyone should follow the money. And I mean, there are people who would stop climate change for maybe nefarious reasons. And I mean, it is the way it works all the way around. But I think that you also have to look at the balance of things. And I think if you go to Open Secrets, if you go to followthemoney.org, you see how much money is coming from one side, and you see how much money is coming from the other side, and you should know where all the money is coming from, but it's not equivalent, and it's the resources on one side are not equal to the resources on the other side, and I don't know, I think that there are so many like interesting stories, and I mean when you follow the money on both sides, and one of my favorite things, sort of factoids from Open Secrets, is that if you look up BP, their profile on Open Secrets. BP gives most of its money to Republicans. Top executives give most of their money to Republicans. But the company as a whole, donations that come from employees of the company go to Democrats. And Barack Obama was the number one recipient. And it wasn't because, you know, it was like the corporation wanted one thing and their vast, you know, number of employees are just regular people who happen to actually like Democrats a little bit better. And so, I mean, there is a lot of, like, interesting nuance. The thing about Steyer that's also interesting is that he didn't do very well. And the most interesting thing I think about him is that he wasn't able to spend all of his money. He had a lot of money left over at the end of the election, which is weird. Nobody can ever not spend enough money in politics. And so I think that there were a lot of structural things going on. And so I think that was the other thing, is that like it just wasn't as efficient of an operation. And it wasn't an equivalent to the Kochs. I mean, people like to have, you know, this side versus that side, but in that case, it really wasn't. And I think when you, quote unquote, follow the money on that, it becomes clear that there is this sort of imbalance.
And one of the real fundamental questions that we ask when we're doing research on contributions, and so we get, you know, millions. You're sorting 60 million records there, and it's going to be growing 10 million records a cycle from now until a long time. But when we get into and we're looking at a company and we're standardizing and we figure out who they're donating to, the first question we ask ourselves is why? Why are they contributing? We know the Koch brothers are contributing. They don't like the EPA. They're very clear about that. They run oil and gas. They run chemical companies. And they're trying to influence a very specific set of public policy, would be environmental regulation. The Sierra Club, on the other side, has membership of millions. Their profits are, well, they don't necessarily make profits because they're a nonprofit. But their interest, why are they giving? Well, they're giving because their mission is to protect the environment. So when we ask ourselves questions and we're trying to figure out why people are giving, we ask, who do they represent? What are their interests? Are they going to be making money at the end of the day? When you put it in a context of what's the outcome of all this donations, all the money, hopefully that gives some clarity to the readers. There is a conflict, but it's not company against company. It's a public interest versus a private interest. If you go to our website and go to About the Data and pull down to APIs, and then go down to examples, those are they aren't the best and the worst. Those are the Land Journal Constitution is a good example of someone streaming our data to their website. WRAL has taken that the next step to streaming our data to their website and embedding in their stories links to our data. So if you see a candidate's name and click on it, their donor list will come up. You don't even have to click on it. Just scroll over it, and the donor list will pop up. You stay in the story, but the donor list pops up. And that's the kind of innovation that we want to encourage using our APIs. Our documentation is all there under the APIs. And we're working. We actually had a couple people from this conference come up and say, we'd like to do something. When I show them these, it's like, that's it. It's simple, clear. If you have a question, you want to do it, call. We'll put you in touch with the tech guys and make it happen.
Yes.
I mean, there are a lot of different ways to use money. And I mean, you know, some of it is a direct contribution. And outside groups have limited ability to do that because if they're allowed to give, there's usually a cap. And then you have, you know, on the federal level and a lot of state levels, you know, these independent expenditures. You know, you're allowed to spend money on behalf of a candidate. I think what groups like ALEC do, you know, it's not so much running an attack ad on someone's behalf, but, you know, I mean, they spend a lot of money to bring legislators somewhere and provide them with things and to sort of put in their hands. And it's just part of this sort of multi-pronged assault. And, I mean, it goes along with and then there's the money you spend on the lobbyists in the state house. And so it's like sort of six or seven different points. And that's sort of like one genre. Do you know more about, like, the Western governors?
I don't know about the Western governors. I think they all play a role in what we call agenda setting. So before you even get to an election, when you're at a place where you're trying to find candidates to run for office, and the parties often have a hard time getting people to run, the criteria is often, you know, do they have enough money? Do they have the spare time? And then they go, oh, do they fit with us on an issue or two so they can bring them in? So when candidates make decisions about hundreds of pieces of public policy every legislative session, but they're elected on one or two pieces. On the very front side of that, though, is a vast pile of information that's being pushed at them that is, oh, you know, you need to consider environmental policy, you need to consider labor policy. And so everybody is setting the agenda in their own different way, and the amounts of money that are spent via ALEC. ALEC is just a vehicle to get legislation to receptive lawmakers. The labor unions have something, the, you know, Dems have something, progressives. They all have something. But that what goes on in the agenda setting piece is where we're going. We want to, when we get this lobbyist stuff fixed, we want to start going, okay, how is it that the public can have a greater role in setting the agenda for their lawmakers? And there are models now around the world where the public has a bigger role in determining budgeting, in determining what legislation will come up in front of a body, what the priority should be, and even to the point of drafting some legislation. Now, you don't want to, you know, necessarily take that away. You elect people to make decisions. But the fact that the flow of legislation is being controlled, if you know what questions people are going to be debating, then you can pretty much figure out what the outcome's going to be. And so by inserting your friendly legislation up front, you're ensuring you're going to get something at the back end. And ALEC plays simply, and all those groups play a role in that process.
And I think that, you know, at least on the federal level, and I imagine on the state level this is true as well too, lawmakers are very overwhelmed with what they have to do and with the technical level of their decisions that they have to make. I'm trying to think of a good environmental example, but one example I always use when I was Open Secrets was Mary Bono Mack, who's from California, and one time she was in a committee hearing, and it was on a piece of legislation called Do Not Track Me Online, which was about online advertisers being allowed to track you, and she was very, very negative about it. And after the fact, people were like, why were you so down on it? And she said, well, I haven't heard from a single constituent who said that they've got a problem. And I remember someone at the time, like Matt Iglesias or something, wrote this thing being like, that's weird, because Pew says 66% of Americans are disturbed or extremely disturbed in the way they're being tracked. But when you went and you looked at Mary Bono Mack's donor list, it was all people who had a vested interest in tracking people online. Not all, it was about 20% of her money, I think I calculated, came from these people. I don't think that those people gave her money and expected to vote, because again, that would be bribery. But I think that what it was, it's a very technical question. And she spends most of her day fundraising, as most federal lawmakers do. So, you know, she's got to raise $100,000 today. She's got 4 hours to do it. And I come up to her and I say, I'm a lobbyist for Comcast or something. I say, here's a $5,000 check. Here's a $5,000 check from my PAC. Here's a $5,000 check from the CEO, from the CEO's wife, and the CFO. There's $25,000. I just saved you an hour. Do you want to go have lunch? And I go out to lunch with Mary Bono Mack, and I explain to her the common sense in letting, you know, companies track, you know, use it online. And so I think that it's about that. It's a, you know, if you, you know, having the money, and it starts with things like ALEC and providing legislation, and then, you know, that's a very, very, I think agenda setting is right, and sort of fixing the narrative, and then you've got the think tanks that come in and they frame the narrative, and it's a very, very involved and sort of subtle process. And I think that the thing that the Kochs have been very good at and that they've been doing for decades, and it's finally coming to fruition, is they've set up all these different parts of the process. They've set up the think tanks. They've set up groups to help with the legislation. They've set up, you know, they've got money in lobbying. They've got money in PACs. They've got money in the outside groups. And it's a really, really broad thing. It's tough to sort of nail down exactly what each one is doing.
Go ahead, Clint.
Do you track contributions to candidates for privilege commissions that are there elected in Arizona? And because in Arizona, there were allocations of money, very controversial there with the corporation commission.
Right. Yes. We do. And in fact, when people say, you know, what's a good story to do, that's a big picture story, because what you'll have is a lawmaker come in and be a lawmaker, a representative or senator. They will go out and they will run for a public service commission, a corporation commission, insurance commissioner. They will be the regulator for a while. They will then go after office and go to work for the companies they were regulating. That revolving door is an extremely powerful incentive for the elected regulators to be very sympathetic with the industries. I've often said, you know, Eric Lipton last year won a Pulitzer doing some good reporting on attorneys general in the states, and our data was a basis for a lot of his reporting. I think there are dozens of Pulitzers in our paper, in our data, and I think that's probably one of them. The elected regulators going to work for the people they regulate. I mean, it's just, it's almost like the donations to judges. I mean, in a handful of states, you have donations to judges, and that's the Supreme Court case called Caperton, where independent spending got a Supreme Court candidate elected, and he a chief justice. And anyway, he was on the front page of New York Times on the French Riviera with a major donor, a coal company, with their girlfriends. So it ended up in a Supreme Court case. The idea that in places where people have very specific powers, control over a decision process, the incentive for being friendly or, you know, using that power is huge. So that's an amazing story. I would like to see it across the country, but certainly breaking it down for your state and looking back not at just who's there now, but go back 10 years and find out who are the top communications people in the power companies, who's being overviewed, or power companies, insurance companies in your state. Who are the CEOs? Who are the vice presidents? And seeing how many of them were former lawmakers?
Any more questions? You can keep firing if you'd like to.
The funny thing about campaign finance is that, you know, when you do like a national poll, everyone is upset about it. You know, the liberals think that the Kochs are controlling things, and the conservatives think that Tom Steyer or George Soros or the unions or something like that. And it's funny because, you know. And it goes back and forth. In the 90s, the Democrats had a real advantage with soft money, and you know, we had Mitch McConnell like arguing about the need for more controls on it, and now he's the opposite because he thinks his side has the perceived advantage. But when you talk to regular people, something like 80 to 90% of people say that they're concerned about the level of power that special interests have. But it has become very politicized. Right now, Citizens United is something that Democrats don't like. And so I don't know how you would overturn it. The Supreme Court has had an opportunity. They had a case that came out of Montana a couple of years ago where they could have, people thought, oh, well, maybe this will be their chance to take another swing at it, and they definitely did not. And then McCutcheon came up, and they kind of showed definitely what side they're on. You know, you could have Congress do it, but Congress, you know,
it's stuck right
they,
now.
They can't even get a leader for the Speaker of the House, much less, you know, campaign finance reform. And so I think what my opinion has always been was that we got the campaign laws, what remain of them we have now, out of Watergate, which was a national scandal. And Watergate was a campaign finance scandal. It was about, you know, how the president was using his reelection funds. And it was something that upset enough people on both sides. And there was a lot of partisanship back then, but it was something that bothered people across the board. And so you got some rules. And I think that unfortunately we're going to have another scandal the size of Watergate to have any sort of action on this. The good news, I guess, especially if you're a reporter who's looking for a Pulitzer, is that from the people that I've spoken to, every day that we don't have the Watergate scandal break, exponentially the chances of it coming today are even higher. Like, I mean, it's going to happen. It's going to happen any moment. It could be happening right now while we're sitting here. And you know, there, I mean, we've talked to people who, you know, lawyers who work in these, some of these dark money groups, and one in particular said, I feel like I'm walking through a minefield, and at any moment I could step on something, and it's going to blow up, and it's going to be really bad. And honestly, I don't know if it's going to be on the left or if it's on the right, but mm-hmm. but I mean, and you know, it could take another 10 years, or it could, like I said, be happening right now. So, but I think that the impetus is going to be a gigantic scandal. And so, but for a reporter, I mean, there's lots to do. And I think, you know, when you said that there are multiple Pulitzers in your data, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, there are so many Pulitzers in all of this.
Do you think that, sorry to interrupt you, do you think that it's, that these issues at the state or national level are covered enough by publications, or do you think that there's a lot laying out there?
I think there's a lot laying out there, and I think that the question about getting down to the level of the utility commissions and getting down to the level of the cities and counties is really good. And I think that I was thinking about the mudslide metaphor. Mudslide implies too much of like a natural disaster. I mean, it's intentional. And when I worked at Open Secrets, you know, we're just at the federal level, or they were just at the federal level. And I one of the frustrations I had was, you know, there were stories that national reporters look at. National reporters look at the Koch brothers. Mm-hmm. And occasionally we'd get a call from somebody. And I remember the Americans for Prosperity spent money to defeat an expansion of the Columbus Zoo. And the local reporters saw it, and they're like, that's so weird. Why is this happening? And national reporters didn't know about it. And national reporters are busy at the national level writing about Kochs and everything the Kochs do. And the Columbus reporters are writing about the Columbus Zoo. And no one was sort of like going in between. And I think that what was happening there was that there was, and I don't know what was happening there for sure, but I think if you went and identified the people who have an interest in the Columbus Zoo or in taxes in Columbus, and then you looked at the people who were in the Koch network, you'd be able to find a connection somewhere. And I think that there was an interesting story, but I think it was something that escaped the lower level reporters because they thought, I don't, and I've had, you know, I used to work in newspapers in New Hampshire, and I had editors who said, oh no, that's a national story. You're not, that's out of your, you know. And maybe she was wrong, or maybe things have changed, but I think now the way the money moves, it is kind of like a mudslide in that it comes from the top, but it also goes the other way. And so I think that there's lots of room for every reporter to find stuff and make the connection between the different levels.
Yeah, and so what Russ outlined, the idea that there will be a next big scandal. I mean, we've had a lot of big scandals in the last decade, and not a lot. I mean, we've become sort of like numb to those. I would take us in a different direction. What the Institute has done in building this database has never been done before. Our data doesn't exist, you know, past the 2000 election cycle. So what we've done, one of our targets has been scholars who are studying the campaign finance, the elections processes, and the public policy processes, and understanding the outcomes and all the overlap. And we've worked with, there's a group called the Campaign Finance Institute. The executive director's on my board. His name's Michael Malbin. He's used our data to create a simple, elegant policy, set of policies that are designed to invigorate small donor activity. We know from the Dean campaign and from Obama the power of small donors. And we know now that online activity results directly to offline activity. So if you give $3 to a candidate, you're going to vote for that candidate, probably. So in invigorating that small donor, trying to invigorate small donors, if that's what we think a solution is, the idea that there's a simple policy alternative to do that. New York City actually has been doing it for a long time. So a $50 donor, if a candidate goes and talks to a $50 donor, they get $300 from a public fund. So that small donor looks like a $350 donor. By changing the incentives, why candidates run and what they're and who they're talking to, we also know that the candidates who go out and knock on doors win. Candidates who have the Meg Whitmans of the world who spend hundreds of millions of dollars don't create the grassroots. They don't win. Self-finance candidates don't win the majority of the time. So the idea that there is a solution, a very elegant policy solution, it's not about limits or anything else. It's about encouraging candidates to talk to people about issues, get them out to vote. I mean, there are other things. People have said, let's create New Hampshire everywhere. So you have, you know, 500 House districts in every state. So you know your neighbor, if he runs for office, you know who he is. Or the Australia solution, where everybody has to vote. Instead of advertising to these guys or these guys, you're advertising to the whole friggin' country, and you have to change how you talk to voters. So it's not that there aren't solutions, it's that we're stuck in this little circle, and hopefully, maybe then, a scandal results in a bigger discussion about what we think a healthy democracy will be.
Okay, next question?
Yeah, I mean,
could you identify yourself? Sorry.
I used to be an active reporter in D.C. Columbus, Ohio. And I always found that, I would churn out these stories all the time about federal election commissions and all of the state finance. And they would run, and nobody really cares.
Right.
And you talk to your editors, and maybe it's some inside page story or some story that's buried somewhere. And then life goes on. And I know that you're arguing that we need to have this total revolution and have this big change of the political system, but I don't know. I'm somewhat skeptical.
No, editor fatigue is serious, and reporter fatigue is serious, and reader fatigue is serious. I mean, people don't want to read the horse race stories. Those mean nothing. They are throwaways. They're fish wrapper. But when you can tell a story, so one of my favorite story from this just past year was out of the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting. The lead was about three elderly women dying in a nursing home. I mean, it grabbed my face and pulled me into the paper, and I said, holy shit, this is an interesting story. You read through it, you found out that the owner of this nursing home change was manipulating the regulation of nursing homes to reduce staff and reduce oversight, and he was using his elected officials to do that. Until we can connect, until you can tell a story and connect people with their daily lives, we are going to continue having a problem. And it is the hardest thing we can do, is try to help you do that and for you to take that story and give it a face and make it impact everyone's daily life. Because mom has to get the kids up, get them to school, go grocery shopping, and she's got a dozen other things in her job as a mom that have nothing to do with money and politics. People don't care about money and politics, but they will care if they find out that their schools, you know, the budget's cut and they're going to have 80 kids in a classroom instead of 40, which should be 20. So if you can connect with people's daily lives and show them that it is in sometimes a life and death situation, that's how things are going to change.
I would agree. You know, as a campaign finance reporter, that is a struggle that when I was a reporter at Open Secrets, anything I wrote went on the website. It was great because that's all they do is campaign finance. Working at Mother Jones has lots of different interests, and I have to fight to get my stories in. And it is something that I've been thinking about a lot lately, is how do you do it? And there's also been a huge proliferation of campaign finance reporters. Every publication has, at the national level, has a lot of them. And they're writing, the new horse race story is how much did the super PAC raise? Mm-hmm. And everyone races to find out first who won. And I keep telling my editors, I'm not going to be the first person to get that story. But I think that there's a lot of different angles on it. And it's also a tough job because it's something you can be very cynical about. And, this is really depressing to watch this all happen and have a front row seat for it. But the thing that I love about being a campaign finance reporter is that it touches everything, and nothing. Very few things happen in this country without the government's involvement on some level, whether it's local, whether it's county, whether it's state, whether it's federal. Everyone pays taxes, and the manufacturer of almost everything, the regulation of things. There's so much involved, and campaign finance often has to be the backbone of the story. But right, finding how people are dying, finding how people are losing their homes, those sorts of things. People still read those things. And there is this, 80 to 90% of people are upset about the issue. But just talking about it in the FEC reports, just talking about these sort of things, you got to go more than that. And I think that's the great opportunity, especially for environmental reporters, because a lot of the time the impact of a decision is visually apparent, or it has health impacts, or it's the cost of your electricity or that sort of thing. So I think that you have environmental reporters cover a lot of things that make really great stories, and the campaign finance is key to it and should be brought into it. But right, stay away from just those boring old stories, because the editors don't want them and readers don't want them, and they'll just make you they'll just make you depressed trying to write them. So,
any more questions? Oh yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is, because I think that. So my wife is also a reporter. She covers financial services for the Wall Street Journal. And I'm always like, you know, she's talking about a story about a member of Congress, and I'm always like, did you put in the story that he got $50,000 from Goldman Sachs? And she's like, nobody gives a shit. Like, everyone knows that. Everyone in Washington knows that. And so I think the reporters sometimes, and I mean, I love my wife. She's a great reporter. And she does put that important stuff in the story sometimes. But I think that, like, it's easy for reporters, and especially when you think you know your audience. And I think, you know, I think it's sometimes in her case, like the story for the Wall Street Journal would be if Goldman Sachs did not give that guy $50,000. That would be the story. And I'm not joking. Like, that would be the story. But I think that, you know, reporters sometimes don't, especially when you cover politics. I think this with political reporters, and they look at it and they're like, well, this is the way Washington works. Or this is the way, you know, like Ohio works.
I can testify to that. It is very difficult.
Yeah. And so I mean, and then you got someone from like a place like Open Secrets being like, come on, Goldman Sachs, write about that. And you're just like, come on. You know, like, but I think that when you look back, like I said, government affects everything. And you don't get what you want in government without asking for it. And you don't just write them a letter. Like, money and organization and very sophisticated lobbying efforts, whether it's lobbying with a capital L that fits the legal definition, or whether it's lobbying with a small L, you have to do something. And so I think that, you know, I'm not an expert on ALEC, but I mean, like, they're right that I find it difficult to look at a story like that and how the reporter did not include that stuff. It's hard for me to understand. But at the same time, like, you know, after a while it gets boring. You only have so much space. You know, your editor's sick of you writing about this stuff and wants you to write more stories and not just focus on this one thing. So, I mean, you gotta find the balance. But again, like, I think within an environmental beat, like, you've got a lot of opportunities to hit a subject that the political reporters maybe think is boring or told.
I think that one of the issues that working now in D.C. for at least 3 years, covering Congress specifically, first energy and environment, and then now just all of Congress. Something that I see is that, yes, journalists kind of become desensitized to those issues, and they lose a little bit of their outrage, I think, when they're covering Congress day to day, because you get so wrapped up in that rat race that it is. And trying to build sources with these lawmakers who are trying to keep everything very close to the chest. And so I think that
issue. Like, the other thing, and, you know, Larry Lessig wrote about this, and it was what I was describing before. When you see a list of donors to a member of Congress or to a local legislator, it's not people that have bought him. It's people but it's a list of people he's spending time with. It's the mm-hmm. people who took, you know, Mary Bono Mack out to lunch to talk to them about this very technical subject. And so the reality of it is, you know, it's got the same point. The same point is that money influenced the decision. But the reality of it is it's really boring, kind of. And a lot of it's like an ALEC meeting, I've never been, but I imagine that they're pretty boring. Like, it's a bunch of, like, kind of boring people. I mean, I don't find state legislators compelling people, but I think you have something a little wrong with you to be elected. But so it's a big group of these people, and they're talking about really policy stuff. That's why I think it works so well, is because, you know, nobody wants to talk about this stuff, and then they're handed this piece of legislation, and they don't have to think about it too hard, and there it is. So, I mean, I think it is tough, because, and I think that is part of it, is that you see the system working, and it's hard, because nobody is handing someone a briefcase full of cash. It isn't outright bribery. It's this much more subtle, but arguably more nefarious thing. And I think that was the thing Lawrence Lessig talks about, is it's subtle, but maybe more nefarious, and harder to root out.
I'm going to go back there first, and then
So I'll talk about the federal level. You can talk about the state level. So at the federal level, I don't know if it has gotten better. The Senate, for example, still files everything on paper, and so the filing deadline for this quarter will be October 15th. Probably electronic versions of what they did won't be available until sometime in November, depending on which member, because they file on paper and then it gets brought to the FEC, and then the FEC scans it and then prints it out and then mails it to Virginia, and then someone in Virginia types it in. I mean, it's this ridiculous process that takes weeks and weeks and weeks. Other stuff is more, you know, like within a day, within hours of it being filed, it'll be online. But I mean, we're still like, we're looking at a quarter, like on the federal level, it's right now quarterly is the way the presidential candidates are doing. So on October 15th, we'll have the data from July 1st to September 30th. Super PACs aren't going to file again until December, so it is tough. And then the other problem that you have with the timeline is that the real key is, like, when did they get this money, and what did they do when they had the money? And at least on the federal level, you can't do much with that, because it's very, very imprecise in terms of when the actual, you know, like, you go to a fundraiser today, but you might have sent the check 2 weeks ago, or they know you're good for it, so you'll send the check in 2 more weeks. And so it can actually be very sort of tough, even when you have it instantaneous. The one thing that's almost instantaneous is independent expenditures, which are these super PAC ads. They're within 24, 48 hour of running it. It's filed online. And that's about as close as you get.
So that's one state. The 50 others each have their own set of reporting deadlines, the reporting requirements, the reporting forms. Some are electronic, some are not. We still do input on about 9 states. I don't know that any state is completely electronic. If it's an electronic file, we can go in and get it. And the way typically it'll work, you have the off year, there will be fundraising during that year, and then there'll be one report filed for that whole year. And then as you're coming into the primary, you'll have a pre-primary, and then a pre-pre-primary, and then a post-primary, and then a pre-general, and a pre-pre-general, and then a post-general. Our data at the state level flows in, tends to flow in from November, December, January. And it's the December, January where we're getting the pre-general reports and the post-general reports. The vast majority of the data flows in.
1 minute left.
1 minute left. So the candidates report, it takes a while to go through the agency. Then we get it. We get it up as fast as we want. If you want to prioritize, just give me a call. We prioritize data.
One final question, if you can make it quick.
Quick one. We all know federal congressmen, people know who they are. But you find some of the better stories actually are in the state legislatures where people are running and there's a lot less publicity given to them. And then secondly, does it make a difference if you have term limits? Is there a greater reluctance to give the people as they near the end of their cycle, like they've given their 4 years to exceptional?
My really quick answer is state is much more interesting because Congress isn't doing anything, and Congress is such a mess. And there are so many other. And when Congress does do something these days, it's crazy and doesn't necessarily have anything to do with like an issue. The thing about term limits, the only thing I think about term limits is that it really changes the power structure in terms of the money because people don't have time to get in and get huge sums of money and sort of establish themselves as dominant.
Okay.
Wow.
Like, did we break something?
So obviously I'm going to say yes, the better stories are at the state level, and the even better stories are at the county and city level where you do have major donors having impact.
Okay, and that wraps up the panel. I have to urge you to go to the Oklahoma Ballroom for the plenary session and lunch. Thank you.